And once again this morning, we get to say hello to Dr. Nancy Nielsen. Good morning to you, Doctor.
Good morning, Jay.
Last week we talked about a clinical trial for a vaccine, and we hear news of a second vaccine that's up for clinical trial. What can you tell us about this?
Well, this was really very important and just came out a couple of days ago in the literature, which is different than when the CEOs say everything is going swimmingly. This has been peer-reviewed. This is the Oxford vaccine. Now, there are over 20 vaccines that are in clinical trials, but we talked last week about one that used messenger RNA to produce antibodies. This one does it differently. It uses a genetically modified adenovirus. Both vaccines try to produce neutralizing antibodies. Both need two doses, and both stimulate these interesting immune cells called T cells. Now, our federal government has invested billions in these efforts, including the one in Oxford in the UK, with the promises that we will be able to get vaccine doses if they're effective.
That brings us maybe into the lab a little bit here. How scientists have to go about approaching this. There's got to be immense pressure. Everybody wants the answer now. How do scientists, these people inside these labs, how do they go about dealing with these problems?
Well, the scientific method basically is about learning. We observe, we measure, we test, we modify. So we acquire knowledge by questioning, not by assuming. That is not what politicians like, of course. They like answers, they like much more direct approaches. But it's really important to remember that even as we've looked at things like, should we wear masks, how important what we have learned is, and how important it was to recognize that over 40% of people with this virus are totally asymptomatic and yet can still spread the disease. So one should not be confused about the measure, you test, and then you modify. It's the learning that's the important issue, and that's how we get to answers that are safe.
Also, look at a couple of new studies about the infection rate in the United States. That tells us that perhaps maybe the infections are far higher than what we assume is the case right now?
Well, you're absolutely right. It may be a little bit frightening to see that we're up to 31 states on the governor's blacklist. And the last time I looked, there were about 3.9 million cases in the U.S., But CDC looked at blood collected for other reasons, such as for simple cholesterol testing, and they tested that blood for antibodies. And it appears that the infection rate with COVID-19 may be actually about 10 times more than the 3.9 million reported cases. That would mean about 39 million people have had the disease. That's good, but remember that's still far less than the 200 million who would bring us herd immunity. So the bottom line is most Americans are still vulnerable to this virus, and we should not let down our guard.
And just playing with the numbers there a little bit, 200 million might provide us herd immunity. That's about two-thirds, a little less than two-thirds of the country. What about in some of these regions where the virus has been particularly well spread already? Western New York, one of them, obviously New York City. Is there any kind of thought that perhaps maybe herd immunity might be showing up in some of these regions that have been particularly hard hit?
Well, not really yet. You know, the actual antibodies measured in New York City was just shy of 7%. That tells us that even if it's 10 times that, maybe in that area you're beginning to get some herd immunity, but I think we can't assume that. And how will we know? Well, we're going to know if people don't stop going to bars and congregating, as we've seen develop surges in other areas of the country. So the study that the CDC did has not been replicated in New York City, to my knowledge. But you raise a very interesting point. The places that have been very hard hit might be the first to develop herd immunity. But with travel, you can't expect herd immunity to to protect unless the entire country is protected.
We want to talk a little bit about the National Academy of Medicine. You noted for me that you are a member of the National Academy of Medicine, and it's being asked by the Trump administration to do some work for it, I guess, the best way to describe it. Can you elaborate a little on that?
Well, this started Tuesday of this week when five leading pharmaceutical companies appeared before Congress. Now, usually when they come to be whipsawed because of high pharmaceutical prices. But in this one, they were the good guys. They are the innovators. And so they're the ones that have accelerated and invested in research, even though they know full well that some of the research is not going to pan out. And as I mentioned before, the U.S. has invested billions in helping them do that. So the pharmaceutical companies agreed that they would not compromise safety, but they asked the federal government to decide how to allocate and distribute any vaccines that were found to be safe and effective. So because of that, the Trump administration, meaning the CDC and HHS, have asked the National Academy to try to establish priorities, such as for hard-hit communities of color, and to develop guidance for distributing the vaccine equitably. So the first meeting of their committee, and this is a star-studded committee, will begin to meet on Friday of this week. I happen to know one of the people on the committee, Dr. Reed Tuckson, a remarkable physician who will be very effective. So we can look forward, when we have a safe vaccine, to make sure that it is distributed to the places that need it most, and not just because of political pressure.
And when a committee like this, can you take us inside and how these perspectives can come together, what these committee members might be bringing to the table that are a little different than the others? Can you maybe just elaborate on those dynamics a little bit?
Absolutely. So these are all people of renown. These are folks who are not politicians. These are renowned scientists, renowned observers of the human condition. And they are not expected to have the same opinion, but they are expected to look at the science. And so they come together. They don't always agree immediately, but they hash it out, come to consensus, and that's the way scientists work.
Dr. Nancy Nielsen, as always, thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure.